This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. That's 855-752-4842. You can text us at that same number. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesdays with my co-host, Sandy Williams, and you. Governor Tony Evers will give the annual State of the State address this Wednesday, January 22nd at 7 p.m. Tune in to Civic Media for special coverage of the speech. The Republican legislative response and analysis you won't find anywhere else. Join Civic Media's Todd Alba, political editor Dan Schaefer, members of the Civic Media news team, and Up North News Radio Pat's Kreitlow for special live coverage of the 2025 State of the State address. Find out what Wisconsinites can expect from our state government this year from Governor Tony Evers and Republican legislative leaders. Special coverage begins just before 7 p.m. with coverage across Civic Media Network, News Talk Network, and on the Civic Media app. So, Sandy, let's get into the dismantling of diversity, equity, and inclusion. The administration will take steps to roll back federal support for racial equity and protections for transgender people. President Trump on Monday ordered his administration to gut policies instituted under the Biden administration to prevent discrimination against transgender Americans and dismantle federal programs that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. Sandy, I will say to you as a 70-year-old black man who's lived in America my entire life and who knows the history of the civil rights movement and who knows about the history of our nation and what transpired in the founding of this nation, and to look at it and some of the strides that were made during the 60s and the civil rights struggle and the fight that my parents and others put up just to make it possible for people of color to be able to sit down at a lunch counter to drink out of a water bubbler, the same water bubbler, to go to the toilet, to be buried in the same cemeteries. All of those things happen in this country, and they are documented. And so they occurred. And so when, as a now middle-aged man.
Hey, Earl, we're beyond middle-aged.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay.
Just helping you.
As an older guy. To watch those things being dismantled, Sandy, I am outraged. And the fact that there's so many in this country who agree with that and saying that, okay, we understand it's discriminatory, DEI is discriminatory, and so it's not fair, it's not right. And I say to that, 400 years of discrimination was not right.
Well, incidentally, DEI really isn't. Most of the programs are not, don't involve any required actions other than education. Much of DEI is an effort to simply educate people about what it is that might be involved with hidden bias and with the underlying causes of the kinds of things that relate today to unequal opportunities. And, you know, the vestiges of what you describe exist in some very tangible ways. I was involved working for a bank making mortgage loans in the 60s during the time when I was in school. And we had a map that showed us where we shouldn't make mortgage loans. And it was the red line map. And it was actually a red line map that I think was created by Fannie Mae, which was a quasi-federal organization that said, don't make loans here because we won't. And it was what has become Milwaukee's inner city. It created the segregation in our housing that exists today, to this day, as the result of the echo effect of that very concept, which wasn't just the implicit racism, but it was actually explicit profiling that was done. And so, you know, we have many vestiges of that problem. And I, for one, lived through the whole thing myself. And looking at it from the other side of this mirror, I would say that today things feel worse than they did 20 years ago. There was the time when Obama was elected where we thought we were in post-racial America. It's not post-racial, it's re-racial America, I think, that we currently live in. And so I think that we have work to do, and we have continued to have work to do. But, you know, this executive order that was discussed, it's interesting that they describe it as an executive order designed to remove the favorite the government programs involved with, and the first thing they mention is transgender, and then they mention race, which of course DEI is fundamentally about race. Transgender and the whole gender issue is a very, very minor, small portion of that, just based on the numbers of people involved in it. But transgender is the one that seems to catch everyone's eye and catch everyone's ire, and then they want to kind of slip under the rug there, the whole aspect of it that really relates to race. And, you know, it's very concerning, I think. I understand your outrage, and I think we ought to talk about that some more, because I think the world needs to understand what it feels like to a black person to have this kind of discussion by white America about the problems they have with a program called DEI.
You know, Sandy, Dr. King talked about white backlash, and white backlash existed during the civil rights struggle. Whites who raised up against what was going on and pushed back and didn't want to see those things change. Well, today, when we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, there's white backlash. Because whites are saying, wait a minute, you're discriminating against us, and you don't level the playing field by discriminating. Well, I'll say to many, and our phone lines are open at 855-752-4842. This is not a comfortable conversation for many whites. All whites aren't a part of this, but there's a segment who are. And so to act as if things, I'll tell you, you talked about Fannie Mae. In 1980 or so, Sandy, American Family Insurance was sued for refusing to insure black homes. As recent as 1980s. And they were sued, and they left the city, and then they came back after they had to pay, you know, for being exposed for what they had done. Now, I get it. There are people who think that, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion has caused a lot of damage to many whites, and so as you talked about in going to schools.
Well, I'm not sure, you know, you say it has caused much damage. I think that the school I went to long ago. Harvard College has the makeup of its class has changed substantially since I went there. I had an African American roommate he was one of 14 African Americans in the class of 1966 at Harvard University. Now there are many more than that, but there ought to have been many more than that then. And, you know, so the recognition of the value that can be brought to a group setting like a university of people of all different backgrounds is fundamental to part of the education process. And so universities have, yes, changed the way they address the applicants to their schools, and they've attempted to create a diverse population that will be more educational to all of those partaking in the education. Does that have an effect on the ability of a white American to get into the school? Well, maybe. But is it a function of a loss of meritocracy? No, they're still measuring merit. They're measuring merit as far as the university climate is concerned and what the university wants to achieve. And they also recognize that the way that merit has been tested in our society, for instance, test scores or GPA, isn't necessarily a reflection of the merit that that individual have in terms of their probable success in the world. And so, you know, DEI, much like critical race theory, have been our initials, an acronym that has developed a reputation that isn't consistent with what it actually stands for. Now, DEI is a much more passive principle. It really relates much more to education than it does to action.
Well, you know, Sandy, if you look at...
And by education, I don't mean educational institutions. No. It means teaching, for instance, within a corporation, teaching...
The differences that exist in people.
The differences that exist, yes, understanding them.
You know, Sandy, this thing that, you know, whites are being turned away in these major Ivy League schools because... You know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. I would say that any black person who's been admitted or given an opportunity to go to a Harvard or a Yale or Princeton is not some guy who's there or girl because of DEI. They certainly are bright enough to succeed in that environment, or they wouldn't be there. Let's be clear with that. The other side of it is. Many of the Asians who also are there because clearly their grades might outstripe many of the whites.
Well, and maybe some of the whites are there because they were wealthy enough to go to Exeter Academy and get in that way. You know, so, I mean, yeah, there's all different criteria and all different...
But we don't hear all that aspect of it. We only hear these other anecdotes.
Yeah, but this notion that we're losing our meritocracy.
All right, 855-752-4842. Sandy Williams and you on the Earl Ingram Show.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Waking up in my college dorm. Yeah, my life, it was pretty normal. Looking for a date to the spring formal. Wasn't worried about nothing else, no. Majoring in undecided, notebooks full of bad songs I was writing. Never dreamed anybody else would like them. Now they're sitting on a Walmart shelf. Ain't it funny how life changes? You wake up, ain't nothing the same. And life changes. You can't stop it, just hop on.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. Text us at that same number. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesday is my co-host, Sandy Williams, you and Sandy the Music.
Well, just like this music said, life changes. It's looking at the perspective of we've got a life to live. We've got to figure out what we're going to do, what we stand for. We've got to face up to the life that the whatever life presents us.
All right, let's go to CJ. Good morning to you, CJ. You say what?
Good morning, Earl and Sandy. Thanks for taking my call. Yesterday was a beautiful day. Heard President Number 47 speak that he has the same dream as Martin Luther King. The end of
hey, well, you know what? I didn't hear that. I heard Dr. King speak. I know of what was in his heart and what he attempted to do. And I heard Donald Trump speak. And they're as far and them and their understanding of people and wanting to bring people together as far away from the sun is to Pluto.
Well, you know, listen to you guys last hour, and your party was okay with the tech oligarchs when they supported Biden. Zuckerberg spent over $400 million trying to get Biden.
He didn't have an office in the White House, CJ. He wasn't in charge. He wasn't in charge of impacting the federal government and making decisions to impact the government.
You know how much money the military spent on DEI? They asked for $114 million.
Hey, CJ, what is DEI? Your definition. CJ, what is your definition of DEI?
Division, exclusion, and indoctrination. That's what it is.
Okay. Clearly you don't have any understanding of what it is. That's not what it is. That's your interpretation. It's 100% inaccurate.
You've got to keep people in groups. That's what you have to do. Drive racism. That's what your party's all about.
CJ, thank you very much for the call. There are people who agree with CJ,
Think the problem is that as soon as something is reduced to an acronym and isn't described or discussed in terms of its content, it's subject to being mocked or put into calumny in the manner that we just heard. Now, $114 million by a military that spends $850 billion is actually a pretty small number. $114 million when you consider that there are 2 million employees associated in the Department of Defense means that they spent, what, $57 per employee on this? So, I mean, it's not a huge number, in fact. But secondly, I think that the content of what it is that is involved with DEI should have been discussed and should be discussed because it actually is pretty easy to understand and to evaluate, and it loses a good deal of this kind of acrimony associated with it if it's understood. Many corporations are continuing to use DEI. Many corporations use DEI without any legal requirement that they do so whatsoever. There is no legal requirement for DEI in most of corporate America. It has been adopted through the human relations principles because each company believes that it's good for the interests of the company to adopt it.
So, Sandy, why do you think that this was, of all of the executive orders and the priority and the importance that President Trump saw, that this found its way amongst all these others? Why did the DEI have a seat at the table?
Well, I think you ask a very good question. Why is it that something designed to try to improve relations, improve opportunities, and to improve the environment in work situations, why would that be a focus? And it's interesting because obviously, I think off the air when we started talking about this, you talked about the fact that the majority of America is white, and the majority rules in a democracy. And apparently, this whole concept of DEI seems to fly in the face of the interests of white America, and it gets them very disturbed. But it's interesting to me that the things that they paint, they start out with transgender issues in the discussion, and then in the background they talk about the race issue, when in fact race is the underpinnings of DEI, and the transgender issue is a very small piece of the pie.
So, Sandy, that's it in a nutshell. And so that's the part of it that angers me, because when they preface it, because at the beginning of this article in today's New York Times, it says the administration will take steps to roll back federal support for transgender people and racial equity. But transgender first.
Yeah, I know.
And people bought into that.
Well, they stepped into the trap because that's the way the press release was written by the White House. And, you know, that's the shiny object that can be used to deflect attention from the prospect that this is actually about race, and that the bulk of DEI programs are all about that. And too much paid to the notion that transgenderism is what it's all about, when in fact, that's not the case.
You know, Sandy, I want to delve deeper, because you and I and many others saw when this reared its head before the campaign even began, the critical race theory. All of those things all were put out there, and people bought into all of those things, and it led us to where we are now. 855-752-4842 is the number. Our phone lines are open. Sandy Williams and you on the Earl Ingram Show.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. Text us at that same number. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesday's with my co-host Sandy Williams. Sandy, the music.
Yeah, just about. Let's take what's served to us. Let's stand for something. Let's go ahead and get things accomplished.
Sandy, there's so many things going on right now, simultaneously. The ceasefire in Gaza. Sandy, I couldn't help but look at, you know, all of the visuals. And what I saw were thousands and thousands of Hamas fighters out in the open, celebrating with Palestinians. And I thought they had eradicated Hamas. All of this destruction and killing of many innocent people under the guise that we're going to destroy Hamas. That's constantly. And they're not going to be allowed to come back into God. These are words that were repeated over and over and over.
Well, when you think about it, who were they negotiating with but Hamas, right? I mean, Hamas was sitting at the other side of the table, had to agree to the ceasefire. Hamas is an entity that exists, whether Israel wants them or not. Interestingly, Hamas is an entity that exists because probably of the oppression that has been experienced in Gaza, and it's able to recruit people for that reason. Yes, it might be supported by Iran and other third parties, but it obviously has a willing group of participants within it. And what has happened over the last year has undoubtedly strengthened the ability of Hamas to go out and recruit as it has in the past. So, you know, the principle that Netanyahu announced that he was going to eradicate Hamas, get rid of every last vestige of it, hasn't happened, probably can't happen. It's kind of impossible to find an embedded enemy like that. I think the lessons of history have been that guerrilla warfare is almost impossible to conquer to the extent that there is an excited populace interested in participating in the guerrilla warfare. But my hope is that they can move this in the right direction. But now the question is what happens? I mean, Gaza is destroyed. I mean, it looks like the Palisades right. fire in California. So it needs to be rebuilt. These people need to find a place to live. They need to figure out a sustainable political structure for the Palestinians so that they can coexist with the Israelis. I mean, we're kind of back to square one where we've been forever, and they need to figure this out, you know? And so my concern is, are they going to figure it out or not? Can a Netanyahu government be the vehicle in which this is figured out? I think the premise has always been, or the thought has always been, the prediction has always been, that when the fighting stops in Gaza, the Netanyahu government would be supplanted by something else. And so we're going to have to wait and see.
So who are they going to negotiate with? Israel. Who clearly they can talk as they've been talking to the different peace brokers. But in the end, they're going to have to talk to the people on the ground, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're fighting somebody. And that somebody has to agree to a ceasefire. And so there is somebody on the other side of the table.
Representing Hamas.
Representing Hamas and the fighters that are a part of this Hamas brigade. And so, yeah, I mean, that's a reality. And I guess I just don't understand the world suggesting to themselves that they could ignore that reality.
You know, Sandy, you said this. War's been going on what?
A year.
Well over a year.
Yeah.
Early on, I remember us having conversations on the air and you saying they're not going to be able to wipe out Hamas. Now, they've dropped every weapon known to man except for nuclear weapons. They've leveled it. They've flooded all the tunnels. They've done everything. And yet, Hamas is still there. It's going to always be there. Is it safe to say?
Well, there's going to be something there that is the government of the Palestinians, whether it be this de facto entity, the Palestine, which is now some kind of protectorate. It's hard to say exactly what Palestine is today. But, yeah, and the notion that they would have a negotiated settlement means they were negotiating with somebody, and it's the somebody they were fighting. So that somebody exists, and there's no doubt that somebody has the capacity to continue to recruit young men and women into their ranks. And I'm sure that recruitment has, in some respects, been facilitated by what's happened over the last year.
You know, Sandy, not only recruit them, but they all had on the same uniforms.
Well, you know,
they all had weapons.
Yeah, well, they're supported by third parties. There's no question about that. There is no military production capacity to speak of within—
Right.
Within the confines of Gaza or the West Bank, but and so that third party support, yes. But look, this is the Mideast. This is a conflict that has been ongoing for 60 years, 70 years, and 75 years, and longer. And so this is not something that is simply going to get eliminated with the snap of a finger.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty
because sure. I heard the new president, incoming president, say the Middle East is going to be fixed.
Well, that's a formula that has yet to be ascertained exactly. There's, you know, equilibrium could come closer to existing in the Mideast if the right parties decide that they want it to occur, but it's definitely going to have to include Iran as one of those parties. And so the diplomacy with Iran fell apart almost completely under the first Trump administration. And how Iran gets handled is going to be a real issue.
So while we're talking about that, Ukraine, it wasn't talked about. It's still there. They're still fighting, and heavily. What are your thoughts about the direction that our nation goes with Ukraine now?
Well, my view has always been that Ukraine is moving closer to settlement. I realize the war has been gone on longer than I would have predicted, but wars end. Wars, particularly wars of attrition, end. And there haven't been many wars that have gone on other than like the Afghan skirmish that we participated in forever, 20 years. But this is a full-blown trench-embedded warfare and hundreds of thousands of people dying on both sides. I do predict it will end in 2025. I think it would have ended in 2025 on a Biden watch or a Harris watch, and I think it's going to end on a Trump watch in some fashion, because it can't go on forever.
So do you think that as they sit down, Zelensky. Yeah. Do you think that Zelensky is going to be more willing to sit down now that Joe Biden, who clearly financially supported them and was really almost single-handedly made sure that they had the top weapons created to fight back against Russia, to even reach into Russia? Do you think that Zelensky knows that he's not going to be receiving that kind of support, and it makes it easier for him now to capitulate?
Well, I think I don't understand all the machinations of the government inside of Ukraine. I do know that the ultra-nationalists had control and had a lot to say about policies, and that Zelensky was beholden to them in that regard based on the nature of the organization of their government. But I think that the reality is going to end up being the reality that existed in 2021 before the war started, which is that I think that Russia is going to insist on having recognition of its ownership of Crimea, and that it's going to get control over the Donbas region, which is the western region of Ukraine, which has been the place of all the fighting. And I think that the fact that the fighting has localized there, it further demonstrates that that's the area of Ukraine that Russia truly cares about. And I think what will happen is that Ukraine will be a neutral country with protections that are adequate to assure it against further incursions by Russia, and that it will give up some territory. And I think that's the way it's going to happen.
Will those protections come in assurance from protections for protections under the new president?
Well, I think the protections, quite frankly, will be promised by the European countries of NATO. I think that's what Trump has said he wants. I think that's probably what will happen. But I think that will be probably a sufficient promise for Russia to be restrained and for people to believe that Russia will be restrained from any further incursions.
So the rebuilding of Ukraine, which clearly I think if Joe Biden was still the president, would have, you know, the United States would play some role in that.
Well, I think the rebuilding of Ukraine will probably be a private commercial endeavor, quite frankly. I think there will be some government funding grants from other countries, some loans probably from other countries. But Ukraine, in a protected but neutral status, maybe as a member of the European Union, is probably a very valuable place, and there will be a good deal of investment interest.
So let me ask you about our...
And incidentally, most of the destruction of Ukraine has occurred in the Donbas region, which, if Russia takes control of that, will be Russia's problem, not Europe's problem.
So let me... Part of, Ukraine and our relationship, under Joe Biden, certainly favorable. and our relationship with Russia under Joe Biden, not favorable. Our relationship with Russia under Donald Trump was favorable.
Well, it was marginal. I mean, he claimed to have this great relationship with Putin, but there was an ongoing sanction program that was a continuation of the Obama established sanctions that were the result of the Crimea takeover by Russia in 2014. I predict that Trump will try to reestablish relations with Russia and will try to drop the sanction process because commercially, sanctions are difficult in Europe, but also commercially, I think Donald Trump still wants to have a hotel in Moscow. I'm not joking about that. I honestly think that might be a big factor.
You know, Sandy, I know you're not joking, but they have to laugh sometimes to keep from crying.
Yeah.
Because the truth of the matter is, you look at this and his so-called relationship with Vladimir Putin doesn't think very highly of it.
I think it's much like the relationship of Mortimer Snerd and Charlie McCarthy. And the audience doesn't understand. Mortimer Snerd was a puppet.
Yeah.
And Charlie McCarthy was the
puppet master. Yeah.
Puppet master.
Yeah. All right. 855-752-4842. 855-752-4842.
And people should Google, I picked Mortimer Snerd rather than the other alternative puppet for a good reason.
All right. We're going to continue the conversation. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesday is my co-host Sandy Williams and you.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Takes a little while to get into it, but I love this. Who is that? Queen?
No, it's R.E.M., I think.
R.E.M. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842, 855-752.
No, I'm sorry, Aerosmith.
Aerosmith, 4842. General Senator Tillis, Trump pardons raised legitimate safety issue. GOP Senate, Senator Tillis. Anyway, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, and that's a Republican from North Carolina. Where am I at? Oh, I was just reading this breaking news. But welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. It's Tuesday. I mean, Tuesday's with Sandy. So, Sandy, so what's going to happen? Are we going to all of a sudden do away with all these deficits?
Is
Trump going to fix all that?
You know, I've talked to some friends of mine who undoubtedly voted for Trump and are seemingly kind of excited about the prospect. What they all want to talk about is the notion that they're finally going to find someone who's going to take on the government establishment, the old line Republicans and old line Democrats who've been spending money profligately, irresponsibly, running up deficits, and that now this Doge committee maybe promises to change things. Well, number one, they're ignoring the fact that Donald Trump in his first four years in office ran record deficits for any president during his first four years. Secondly, the Republican record is obviously very bad, but if they think they're going to break from the Republican establishment, I think that they're just, you know, this is an illusory kind of a hope and an illusory promise. The first thing that's being talked about is the implementation of a tax reduction, and then later to try and follow up with processes to reduce costs. But, you know, reducing costs means reducing programs, and reducing programs means dealing with the people who have an interest in programs. And so, for instance, you mentioned that there was possibly going to be an executive order issued today about the SNAP program.
Yes.
Well, there are more rural SNAP recipients. More money flows to rural SNAP recipients than to urban SNAP recipients. So there are probably more red voters than blue voters affected by that. And that's just an example. But most of what they talk about being waste is not inefficiency in government. It's actual programs in government that they want to wash away, they want to eliminate, without talking about which programs they are. These programs all got enacted for a reason. And, you know, to the extent that they want to get at waste, like inefficiency waste, they're going to have to dip their hands deep into the Defense Department budget, because everyone knows that there's a great deal of inefficient waste embedded in the Defense Department budget. Nobody thinks that there's a lot of inefficiency in the Social Security budget or in the Medicare budget. And so they're going to have to dip into programs and to eliminate actual
they
programs.
They don't want to, they don't, Donald Trump said he wants to rebuild the military. He doesn't want them dickering with what's going on there. Let's go to Bob from Waukesha. Bob, thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Hi, Earl.
Hello.
Well, the clown show has started. You know, Trump complains about the immigrants causing all this crime, but he pardoned all the domestic terrorists that participated in the insurrection. 1,500 of them are going to be back out on the street. It makes no sense. Trump's whole presidency, he makes no sense. He's nothing but a corrupt con man, and he's conning this whole country. That's all I got to say.
Hey, Bob, thank you very much for the call. You know, Sandy, when they are talking about $800 billion, Elon Musk was talking about $800 billion in basic social programs, waste. And they're we're going after the waste in those programs.
Well, if you call it waste, that would suggest that it's inefficiency. But he's not talking about inefficient waste. He's talking about programs that he disagrees with that need to be eliminated because he thinks the program is superfluous. And that's where this whole thing bogs down, because most of these programs were enacted for a reason, for a purpose. They have constituents for whom it matters. The government is our group funding operation. It's the way that the people decide how they might commingle their money to solve problems that can only be solved jointly and can't be solved individually.
So let me ask you quickly then, because congressmen and senators have constituents who benefit by these programs. Are they going to be willing to cut those?
Well, that's been the problem. And I don't say it's a problem. That's the test that all this cutting needs to stand up to. And it's the reason why the lack of discipline in Washington has been Republican-led tax cuts in advance of any programmatic cuts. We had tax cuts during the war, a huge war, expenditures under George Bush II. We had a tax cut under Trump without any programmatic cuts. That's been the reason for the substantial deficits. People can point at Bill Clinton as a point of surplus. Ever since then, it's been deficits.
All right, we got to leave it there. Thank you very much, Sandy. Thank everybody who made the show go. Up next, Jane Madner, Greg Bach. Madner on air. Stay warm. See you tomorrow.
The national news cycle never stops. but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.